Wagwan, everybody. Welcome to the Dis Afemi History Podcast, where we'll be speaking about history and as well family history and how history relates in terms of Caribbean people for the present as well as in the past, and how in the past, what that does and brings forth for what we are going through at present, and what we can learn from our history, from our family, and take that moving forward. So I do hope you enjoy the podcast. And if you like it, please ensure to subscribe, like, and review. Thank you.
In today's episode featuring Associate Professor Matthew C. Riley at CUNY, who is an anthropological archaeologist interested in race formation processes, whiteness, and colonial modernity in the Atlantic world. We'll be diving into the article, The Irish in the Anglo-Caribbean, Servants or Slaves? So let's have a listen.
Well, thank you so much, Matt, for coming on to the podcast, Dis Afemi History, and for speaking about the article that you wrote in terms of with indentured servitude with the Irish. So before we start, if we could just have you just to introduce yourself briefly, and then we'll start.
Sure. Thanks so much for having me, Wendy. My name is Matt Riley, and I'm a professor of anthropology and interdisciplinary programs at the City College of New York, and I'm also affiliated with the CUNY Graduate Center. So I'm an archaeologist by training, but of the historical period, so that means I dabble in the historical record as well.
Okay, perfect. Thank you so much for that. And we'll start again with the title of the article. It poses the question, servants or slaves? You know, what would be some of the complexities or nuances are surrounding the status of the Irish in Anglo-Caribbean during the colonial period?
Yeah, so the title of the piece really came from the question itself, because I think there had been so much online debate and controversy over the years, especially in the last few years, surrounding the nature of the status of Irish people who had been sent to the Caribbean, many of whom against their will. So with my collaborators for one piece, the one you're referencing, Liam Hogan and Laura McAtackney, and then for another article with Jerome Handler, we set about the task to do a fine grain analysis of the experience and status of Irish people in the 17th century in specific locations, and then to think about the experience more broadly throughout the Caribbean. And they revealed some mixed results. And I think that's what's so complicated about the region at this particular time, because there certainly were elements of consistencies in terms of how people were treated under the law. But at the same time, these things were in development throughout the 17th century. So it's hard to definitively say one way or the other in terms of exactly how an individual would experience a particular status in a place like Jamaica or Barbados, or for the Irish in particular, in Montserrat, for instance. Mm-hmm. So I think there's a lot of different ways you can approach this question. And the primary research that we conducted was to think about how Irish people were written about in official documents, whether that's under the law, in deeds and wills, where property was passed from one person to another. And as we know, of course, chattel enslaved Africans were passed as property from one person to the next. But that was not the case that we found with Irish indentured servants. And as we continued to do this work over the course of several years, it became pretty clear that while the Irish suffered tremendous hardship under these brutal regimes of servitude and exploitative labor, they were viewed and classified as very distinct from that of enslaved Africans. And those differences are incredibly important for how someone experiences their daily lives and how someone thinks about their own positionality with emerging sugar and slavery societies throughout the region. So in general, from the outset, I think we can clearly say that as the 17th century progressed, there were statutes put in place to ensure that Irish servants were distinct from enslaved Africans. So the argument that we put forward is that the Irish were not enslaved in the same way as African people were. And they were treated horribly in many contexts, and we can get into those details, but there was an important socio-legal distinction between the two forms of labor.
No, thank you. And we'll definitely get into that as well, because it's very specific in terms of their differences between the two groups. So would you be able to provide, I guess, an overview of the historical presence and contribution of the Irish in the Anglo-Caribbean?
Yeah, that was another tricky one, a very hard question to tackle. And I think, you know, that's a very, it's a question that many want to be able to answer in a very defined and easy way, that the Irish were enslaved or the Irish did this in the Caribbean. And it's kind of all of the above. The Irish had a very varied role throughout the Caribbean region, and it changed from island to island, especially in the 17th century. And things change, of course, as you move forward in time and get to close to the period of emancipation, for instance. So the work that I've done over the years has primarily been based in Barbados, and that's in both the archaeology and the form of archaeology and historical research. And the Irish in Barbados occupied primarily the role of laborers. There's a lot of historical documentation of thousands of Irish who were sent, most of whom against their will, to Barbados by Oliver Cromwell in 1649, for instance. But there's historical precedent for that as well. So as the English were colonizing in Ireland, all throughout primarily the southern regions of the country, what we would see was that thousands of people would be removed from their land. And almost to kill two birds with one stone, you would have them removed from their land and then sent to Barbados, out of sight, out of mind, mm-hmm. where they would then work in some of the early plantations that were starting to develop at this time. So as the English were colonizing Ireland, it's the same time that the system of sugar agriculture is really developing in earnest throughout the region, after the Dutch bring the technology throughout the region, primarily first in Barbados.
Yeah.
So in terms of the Irish experience in the 17th century, most of the islands would have had a majority of Irish laborers, but this isn't always the case. So for instance, in Montserrat, which is often called the Emerald Isle of the Caribbean, you had a higher number of planters or early small farmers and eventually sugar planters themselves who were of Irish origin. Now, some of these were Anglican planters who were originally living in Ireland with English roots and then came to Montserrat. So there's complexity in their own identities because they wouldn't see themselves as the same as being Irish Catholics, for instance. But there were many Irish in a place like Montserrat where Catholicism may have been the religion of the majority of the population at a particular time, which would have been dramatically different from Barbados or after 1655 in Jamaica, for instance. So there's a mixed bag in terms of the experience, where you have everything from indentured servants to small planters to overseers on plantations, mm-hmm. to full-blown planters and owners of operations, dock workers, merchants living in the urban centers, sailors, full scope of the experience. And then, not to get into the weeds on this one, but things change dramatically as you move forward, where by the 19th century, for instance, there's a growing need for more overseers and middle-level managers on plantations. So places like Jamaica, for instance, see a major influx in the Irish that are coming over to help manage plantation spaces. So there's more Irish and more Scottish as well. But then, you know, there's a whole different range of diversity in terms of what happens to the Irish in the first, second, third generation as they stay in some of these places.
No, that's great that you mentioned that, because again, I came across that in my family tree, to know that the different areas or the different time frames, it was a different type of person that came that was Irish that were not necessarily indentured at that time. So I guess we can talk to that, but can you explore, I guess, the experiences of some of these Irish indentured servants compared to those of the African enslaved in the Anglo-Caribbean?
Sure, absolutely. You know, this is a tricky one, primarily because in those early years, there's so little documented. We do have important council minutes for Barbados, and there's also the wills and deeds that I mentioned earlier. But the experiences, the daily lives of whether enslaved or indentured, these aren't the quote unquote important people in the eyes of planters. So their experiences are seldom written about. And it's usually when problems arise that you see the most detail about what's going on with some of these exploited laborers. And, you know, again, here it's a mixed bag. And I think what's really important is to recognize the choices made by indentured servants in terms of where they would see themselves positioned with the burgeoning of a sugar and slavery system. And in that regard, I mentioned, you know, because some eventually chose to buy into that system. Some would finish their terms of indenture and go on to become small planters, small farmers, go on to own enslaved Africans, and in some cases amass great fortunes. There's a wonderful historian at the University of Alabama named Jenny Shaw, who wrote a great book about the different experiences of enslaved Africans and Irish indentured servants. And early in the book, she mentions a famous case of an indentured servant named Cornelius Bryan, who was brought over from Ireland against his will, serves as an indentured servant, and makes a very rude or harsh comment against his English master, something about the blood on the tray of meat, and it's viewed as a threat to the planter. And he goes on to be punished very harshly. He's whipped in the same way that an enslaved African would have been. So the treatment was very, very harsh. And usually that's where the story of Cornelius Bryan stops, where people say, you know, the Irish were treated just as badly as enslaved African. Mm-hmm. But Jenny Shaw's book traces Cornelius Bryan's life, where he eventually goes on to own a plantation of hundreds of acres with dozens of enslaved Africans. And so here we see a very particular path of one former indentured servant, where there are others who never make their way out of the ranks of mm-hmm. servitude. In some cases, for a minor transgression, your period of indenture could be extended for 1, 2, 3, or even 10 years. It was rare that you got a sentence for life, but that did happen for prisoners of war in some cases. But for the most part, the lifespan of an indentured servant was quite truncated because of the harshness of the daily reality of working in the fields. So if your term of indenture was 7 years, it wasn't uncommon for someone to die before they reached the end of that period of servitude. So in no way are we, you know, dismissing the mm-hmm. hardship experienced by indentured servitude. Anyone who was a laborer at this time in the Caribbean would have experienced these brutalities. But in some cases, like Cornelius Bryan, you have those who go on to be quite successful. In others, there are multiple instances in Barbados, for instance, where Irish indentured servants or former servants band together with enslaved Africans in instances of rebellion. And we see this crop up in 1685, I believe it is. And then there's another case documented in 1656, where it's noted that enslaved people and the Irish were, quote, out in rebellion in a corner of the island in St. Philip, which is further to the southeast. So there were choices made by those who were under this brutal system, whether to buy in or rebel against it. And the Irish were varied in terms of how they made those choices. So I think it's, you know, in terms of the differences with enslaved Africans, you know, they could have experienced quite similar treatment under the law and under the whip of the planter or overseer. But there were more options available. And one thing that Jerry Handler and I have worked on in seeing the legal options that were open to indentured servants, an indentured servant could petition the government if they felt that they were being mistreated or treated too harshly by their planters, something that was never afforded to an enslaved African person. And then crucially for the different status of enslaved versus indenture, we found no single case of when the status of an indentured servant was passed on to their child. Mm-hmm. A staple of African chattel slavery in the Americas, where the status of the mother was passed on to the child in perpetuity for generations, this was not the case for indentured servants. And that's a huge element in terms of the rigidity of that system and what it means for generations of individuals in a space like the Caribbean. So these legal distinctions are crucially important. And then the last one I'll mention, something that's, you know, hard to codify in the law, but what we did recognize in going through a lot of the 17th century archives is that it was very common for indentured servants to be listed in wills and deeds for the amount of time they have left to serve rather than property for life. And interestingly, many times their first and last name is provided. This was never the case for an enslaved African person who were always singled out by their first name only. Mm-hmm. And this doesn't say a lot about legal definitions, but it says a lot about personhood and who someone is as an individual. When someone's recognized by their first and last name, you're giving more of an identity and recognizing their humanity in a way that wasn't allotted for enslaved Africans. And I think these are the subtle differences that point out the extreme difference in socio-legal treatment and experiences of enslaved and indentured peoples.
No, absolutely. It just was, one was more valued than the other, but again, they were afforded certain caveats in the law to be able to have that. So I guess, and then in what ways, in terms of the colonial powers and plantation owners, exploit or manipulate both the Irish and the African laborers just to maximize the profit?
Yeah, that's a really unique question too, because I think it gets into the dynamics of what's happening on individual properties. So the law is certainly kind of the macro scale, how the entire island or partly the region was governing and controlling their laboring population. But what happens on the ground on individual properties can be quite unique. And I think there are ways that this is done ways that we can analyze this using methods within my own field of archaeology that aren't really accessible through historical documents.
Mm-hmm.
And here I'd want to flag work that I conducted in collaboration with my former advisor, Doug Armstrong. And for many years, he worked on Trent's plantation on the west coast of Barbados near what is now Holtown. And when we were excavating on the site, we used a map that was created of the property in 1646. So this is right at the time when sugar and slavery is starting to take hold across the island. And we're starting to see those differences of servitude versus slavery being encoded within legal frameworks. So what does this mean on the ground and on a plantation? And using the map, we were able to locate archaeologically deposits associated with a former outbuilding. Outside, or not the Great House as it would become called, but where laborers were likely living. And we found material culture emblematic of a residency, things you would use in your household on a daily basis. And interestingly, in looking through the archival record and comparing it with the archaeology, at this time, early in the 1640s, 1650s, the property had very few enslaved Africans and mostly indentured servants, some of whom may have come from Ireland, but others came from England. Two actually came from France. So it was a real amalgamation of different origin points. And interestingly, what this was telling us was that in these early years of sugar growth, servants were living quite close to the home of the planters. We didn't necessarily have these huge 300, 400 acre estates that would become typical in later years. So it was a much more kind of personal and intimate environment where servants were living very closely to planters and likely interacting with them in a way that we won't see later. Mm-hmm. And what we do see on this particular property is as we move forward in time to the late 17th century, this house gets abandoned and we see only artifacts associated with sugar production, the drip jars, the molasses jars, the sugar cones. And we then have to look elsewhere on the property for the village where the enslaved Africans are living. So what this tells us is that as time goes on, enslaved Africans are moved to a separate place on the plantation where they live in large numbers at a greater distance from the planters and the nucleus of the plantation. So there's a racial separation that's happening, where you can again see the kind of personal nature of what happens in the early years and perhaps a recognition of the humanity of servants that doesn't translate when we get to increased numbers of enslaved Africans. And this isn't to say that it happened the same way on every plantation, but there are certain intimacies that you see at this particular site that might help us better understand how race starts to develop, mm-hmm. how the Irish had a different experience to that of enslaved Africans, and what it would have meant to live on a space like this as sugar is really starting to take hold across the region and across the island. So I think, you know, more germane to your question about maximizing profit, I think in some cases, what would have been happening around this time was differentiating racial status along lines of what your task would be on the plantation, what your status means in terms of what kind of labor is permissible. And again, indentured servants were suffering under brutal regimes of labor. But eventually what we start to see is rather than your Irishness mattering so much, it's that racial identity of being white. And this is work that one of my colleagues, Catherine Gerbner, and again, Jenny Shaw, they've done an exceptional job in Barbados to highlight how in the early years, the 1640s, 50s, 60s, you come across the term Irish or Scottish quite a bit in the archival record when people are talking about the rebellious nature of the Irish, for instance. But that starts to disappear as we get into the 1680s and 1690s. It's less and less about the differentiation between English, Irish, and Scottish. And now all of a sudden we see modern language of race taking over, where white is being utilized with far more frequency than that of Irish or Scottish. So we can see that change in terms of the spatial layout on the plantation, the labor that's going on, and in terms of the language that's being used.
No, I definitely have seen that in, as I said, in my research, in terms of looking at the maps and seeing where the enslaved Africans were on the property. And it was extremely very far from the main house. And just to still see those remnants that are there, it's just amazing. And to know that you just, you know, that's what you do, and you went and archived it, it is just amazing. But at the end of the day, in terms of, I know that you touched upon in terms of the conditions of indentured servitude, you know, for the Irish did evolve over time, particularly in compensation in comparison to the institution of chattel slavery. Can you speak a little bit more as to what was mentioned before?
Sure. I think, you know, it's a mixed bag again. You know, the treatment of servants would really very much depend on the master at the time, what their individual experience was like. And we do find cases, and this is mentioned in one of the most famous kind of ethno-historical accounts. Richard Ligon has his True and Exact History of the Island of Barbados. And he has a very famous quote from there. You know, I'm going to paraphrase here, but, you know, if there are masters who are kind, so to speak, and then there are those that are very harsh. And you'll find that across the island. He does mention he has seen wickedness done by planters against indentured servants that he would never see elsewhere in the world. And that was likely the case in some instances. So again, you know, extreme brutality. And I think, you know, for many who were sent over against their will, this was something that was just an everyday occurrence in terms of recognizing that there may be little way out, if any. Surviving a period of indenture was no easy feat. But according to the law, even those that were sent over against their will, the law in Barbados was that upon arrival, they would be given a contract. So for a servant, if their planter was amenable to it and if they obeyed the law, there would be light at the end of the tunnel. Awareness that after a certain number of years, they would be free. In technical terms, for an indentured servant who came with a contract, they were supposed to be provided with rations, with shelter, with clothing, and a timeline where they would complete their contract. Did this always happen? It's hard to say. And, you know, there's also ways we can look at this very cynically and see if, you know, if a planter recognized if they had both enslaved Africans and indentured servants on their property, they could very well recognize that indentured servants were a short-term investment and they could work them extremely hard. And then also think, well, enslaved Africans, I need to worry about their longevity and the success that they might have in producing the next generation, for instance. So again, this is a very dark and cynical way to think about the management of labor, but there are ways that this might reflect in the way that a planter might manage their own quote-unquote property. And what we see in terms of for indentured servants, there are instances where people complete their term of indenture and then go on. As I mentioned earlier, Cornelius Bryan is one of them. Very few would go on to extreme success, but that would mean that many had to find their way in a very inhospitable environment. And so while we have a lot of records of indentured servants throughout the 17th century, we have little information on what happens to them after they leave the plantation. And while I have a few of the articles that you've referenced about the difference between servants and slaves, one thing that I've worked on for many years is kind of what happens after, what happens over the next several centuries when indentured servants go to other areas of the island and try to survive on a very difficult landscape. And so in some instances, what we find is that this population that comes to be known as the poor whites or the red legs of Barbados, they start to occupy what in Barbados is called the rab lands, lands that are not accommodating for sugar production. So many of them take up small acreage parcels where they can grow tobacco, they can grow indigo, just subsistence crop farming. This is not an easy lifestyle. They aren't suffering under the whip of a planter, so there's clearly a step up in terms of their status and their free personhood, but they are living a harsh lifestyle in relatively unaccommodating spaces across the island. So for my dissertation project and then for my book, we studied a community on the east coast of the island, which was known as kind of a quote-unquote red leg enclave, where people that were likely the descendants of indentured servants lived in a space that was on the margins of the plantation, where they likely saw and interacted with enslaved Africans, but were not part of that plantation machine in the same way. So indentured servants would have had a very hard time leaving that system behind. They would have been very familiar with it and survived kind of on the fringes for their day-to-day livelihoods for several centuries after the period of indentured servitude declined in Barbados.
Well, definitely. It definitely would have definitely been a challenge. And even if they did leave to go to another island, it's still seeming, you know, they're still facing the same things because, as you referenced, they were considered to be the poor, right?
At the end. Yes. And absolutely. Just a quick reference there. Historian Carl Lotson from Barbados wrote an excellent article about the poor white population in the 19th century. And it's at this time that Barbadian authorities are realizing there's too many of these folks. They're the lowest of the low in terms of what they represent. We need to get rid of them. And the governor of Barbados starts to write to neighboring islands saying, would you like this population? We'd love to send them to you. And all these governors write back, thanks, but no thanks. We're okay here. And a few accepted. So there are communities of Barbadian in St. Vincent, Grenada, and a couple of other places, but it's definitely, it became what Hilary Beckles referred to as the poor white problem at some point in the 19th century.
Yeah, it's unfortunate, but that was the times. And I know you mentioned in terms of some of the legal distinctions, but, and as well social. Can you mention any more? Because there were some specific liners that indicated as to the differences between an enslaved African. And I know you mentioned about the time frame period, and they would become eventually free from that contract. But there were some significant distinctions made in that legal framework.
Yeah, and that's also a tricky one because some of the earliest laws we don't have full text for. We have them in name, but we don't have them written out. And even the famous what's known as the Barbadian Slave Code of 1661, we actually don't even have the full text of that particular act. And it's an act for the governing of enslaved peoples. And interestingly, the act either before or after it in that particular book is an act for the governing of servants. So right there, you know that there are two different legal frameworks for controlling, managing, and legally kind of determining the status of indentured versus enslaved people. And we have most of the text for those 1661 laws, which means that there had to be legal precedent prior, or at least social precedent. So before that, there had to be ways in which planters and authorities recognized that while these were both laboring populations to be exploited to maximize profit, they were not quite the same. And I think that's really significant. So it goes back to the earliest days of the colony for Barbados and similarly for other islands. Because importantly, that 1661 law would spread throughout the region, not just in the Caribbean, but for what would become the United States. So Virginia's law was quite reminiscent of Barbados's, to the point where some of it is almost verbatim about how to govern enslaved Africans. The French Code Noir was similar. So I think it had a major influence on what was already happening at a social level across the region, but then was legally codified. And most of that 1661 law for enslaved Africans deals with how you're able to punish the enslaved for transgressions. You could absolutely do the same for indentured servants, but when you read that 1661 law, it is just kind of, it's fringeworthy and nauseating to see the types of punishments that would be inflicted on enslaved Africans for minor transgressions and punishments, but not the same for indentured servants. And in most cases, a lot of that was adding time to your sentence or your period of indenture. But the extreme violence is not something you see laid out in a legal document for indentured servants. And right there, again, it speaks to what we were talking about earlier about the personhood and the humanity, the value of an individual at this particular time. So that's what we see in those 1661 laws. But as mentioned earlier, you can also see this in wills and deeds, where frequently an indentured servant will be listed for being transferred when someone passes away. And it will say Cornelius Bryan, to use the example from earlier, for the time he has left to serve, indicating very clearly that this is a time commitment or a time length contract, which was not the case for enslaved people. So you see this playing out at all levels of society, from the laws that are governing the islands to the legal documents that pass property from one to another, and then from the social settings on the ground. So there are all kinds of social and legal distinctions between the two forms of personhood or status of indentured and enslaved.
No, I definitely would agree. And you're right. When you see these things in black and white, especially when you're reading wills and you're seeing, especially for enslaved Africans, being passed on from their generation and for even them going listing to say, and their children. And of course, for indentured Irish, you know, again, what you said in terms of their amount that they had left and of course, their full name indicated. So I know you mentioned a lot of different sources that you've used, but can you just kind of list some of the primary sources or historical evidence that you relied on to reconstruct this whole experience of the Irish in the Anglo-Caribbean?
Yeah, I think, you know, from knowing the podcast and seeing the guests that you've had, I know you have had some folks who work in archaeology as well. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think for my own work in Barbados, I think my own experience was a little unique in that I spent quite a bit of time doing excavation, as good archaeologists do. But when there was a period when I was on island by myself for several months, I spent most of that time in the archives. So the Barbados Department of Archives has wonderful resources. You know, I spent countless hours going through wills and deeds, and they have these massive books of wills and deeds from the 17th century, which, you know, if you don't know what you're looking for, it can be very time consuming. And it ultimately does pay off in a lot of ways. And what we were able to, you know, what I was able to find in some instances were small hints at Irish communities. I found in some cases, as we discussed earlier, and I didn't quite get to this, you know, former indentured servants or small planters or small farmers would amass very humble, you know, humble amounts of property or value to be passed to the next generation. And in some cases, we were able to find how an Irish last name would be leaving money or property to another Irish last name. And does this mean we're not talking about 200 acres of a sugar estate, but, you know, a few acres of land for tobacco farming and a few cattle or a few goods that could be passed on. And this was hinting to me, at least, even throughout the later years of the 17th century, that there was this sense of an Irish community that we can see in the wills and deeds. For a wealthy planter who had 300 acres, their will or a deed would be 3-4 pages long. But for a very humble former servant, it would just be a paragraph. And you don't know where to find this stuff. It just takes flipping through those 17th century wills and deeds to really get a sense of what's happening on the island at this time. Moving forward, there are some census records from the 19th century that indicated the lingering identity of Irish personhood on the island. So, for instance, there's been some historical work by Woodville Marshall and a few others on the community known as Irishtown, which was in a very steep area in the 19th century in Barbados. And the census does indicate a thriving population with a lot of Irish surnames and people of African descent as well. But the town was eventually wiped out by land slippages by the end of the 19th century. So, you know, there are all different historical accounts that provide some insights here. And in terms of the punishments of what's happening to people when they transgress or break the law, the council minutes of Barbados are really fruitful in that regard, where you can see the council will dole out a punishment where a case is brought before them. So again, those council minutes are usually when something's going wrong is when you see them being the most revelatory in terms of the intimacies of daily life. And then finally, just a plug for my own discipline, I think the archaeology is a very unique facet of Caribbean scholarship. And it's partly because, as I mentioned earlier, you know, we're dealing with, you know, there's a growing and the huge importance of studying enslaved and other exploited populations. The challenge is that you don't have a rich written record in the same regard as you do for Christopher Codrington or the wealthy planters of the Caribbean region. And so the material record does provide more of an insight into their daily lives in a way that you just wouldn't get from the archival record. And I think this has been really powerful for me over the years. And I think it's something that provides kind of this tangibility to the experience of the enslaved in a way that you just don't get from the archival record. So I'm very happy to see that that's something that's becoming more common across the region in terms of how archaeology is contributing.
No, absolutely. Because when you can actually have an artifact, as you said, that's a tangible source that you can actually see, and your memory can, you know, not your memory, but your mind can kind of go to that and kind of imagine what it would have been like, and to know what they used and stuff like that. Like, I mean, that's just one of those things that is definitely invaluable. And again, it continues onwards with the story to indicate that they were here and they had a life. Yes, it was definitely very harsh, very cruel. But at the end of the day, it shows that they had a mark. They were here and they need to be represented and need to be talked about as well. So the, you know, with history of the Irish in the Anglo-Caribbean has been remembered or memorialized in, you know, how has that been now in contemporary discourse and in cultural representations?
That's such a good question, and one that's been troubling in the last few years. I think, you know, the work that I've done with Liam Hogan, Laura McAtackney, and Jerome Handler has really been in response to a fairly disappointing discourse about the Irish in the Caribbean. And as Liam Hogan has demonstrated, a lot of this is the result of kind of backlash to Black Lives Matter and the murder of Michael Brown and later George Floyd. And in each case in which where we see this massive uprising and resistance for Black lives, we see an uptick in this interest in Irish slavery or the notion that the Irish were enslaved. And, you know, it's a pretty easy thing to embrace. And I think this is what we were talking about earlier, where, you know, you want a simple answer. And if you can easily say, well, the Irish were enslaved, then you don't have to think about the complexities and some of the real challenging elements of what it meant to be an indentured servant versus an enslaved African in the Caribbean during this really crucial time in modern world economies. So I think over the years, there's been this particular push largely coming from right-wing politics about the notion of Irish or white slavery. And so I think the challenge is it often falls along political lines when it's not necessarily a political argument that we're making by reviewing the evidence that's in front of us. And I think, you know, we my co-authors and I certainly have our political values and beliefs, but we're presenting the evidence as we read it from the things that exist. And I think that's one of the frustrations on our end. And I think there are positive signs, though. And I think what's really interesting are, you know, the work that's being done to demonstrate the complexity and diversity of the Irish experience in the region, the good and the bad, and embrace it for what it is, and embrace all of those complexities to see that there were Irish who were planters. There's a wonderful historian, Orla Power, who has demonstrated some 7 famous Galway families who operated massive estates in the Caribbean to great success. The overwhelming majority were experiencing the real hardships of indentured servants, indentured servitude. And I think, you know, after my many years of working in Barbados, which continues on different projects at this point, but in my work in the community on the east coast of the island, where you have the descendants of indentured servants, many of whom were Irish, one thing that I learned in speaking with family members, many recognize their Irish roots in some cases, their last name, some of their cultural traditions that they're very proud of, speak to an Irish ancestry that's acknowledged, that's talked about. But at the same time, many of them also recognize their ancestry to Africa, the family members who are part of this very complex and intermixed family tree that goes back to the 17th century. And so my interest in terms of memorializing and remembering the Irish presence, it shouldn't be kind of cordoned off or siloed into this was the Irish experience, this was the Scottish, this was the African, because we're seeing things that are far more complex. Their neighbors may have been of different origins, but they went through daily life for generations together. And I think that's kind of something that often gets left out of a story where you try to only pick one element and push that forward, especially with a political agenda in mind. And I think that's the kind of work that I'm really looking forward to seeing more in the coming years. And the same would go for, you know, to me, an understudied element of this, not necessarily in Barbados, but on other islands, how the same kind of thing happens with South Asian populations when they arrive as indentured servants in the 19th century. So I don't think there has been that kind of comparison where What does it look like for 17th century Irish servants in Barbados compared to 19th century indentured servants from South Asia in Jamaica? And so this would, I think, enhance our understanding of what labor was like for people who were suffering under these systems and perhaps build solidarity rather than creating divisions between origin stories.
No, I couldn't agree more, because they're not siloed off. Everything kind of mixed and meld. Because as I told you, I mean, my mother's grandmother, her last name was McCormick. So, I mean, it passes on from one generation. It's not, as I said, not just one thing or the other, but I'm glad that you made that differentiation. And so people can be able to know that it's not one or the other. It's a combination, and it has to be looked as a collective and not separate. So, but I guess this goes to the next question in terms of, you know, are there any further misconceptions or myths about Irish in the Anglo-Caribbean that your research aims to dispel?
I think that would be the big one. The one I referenced when I answered the previous question. You know, the notion of Irish or white slavery is something that my colleagues and I have been trying to dispel for several years now. And one of the spaces in which, you know, we're often debated and kind of countered is to say, well, we're dismissing the experiences of indentured servants. And that just couldn't be further from the truth. I think, you know, there, by saying that there was no such thing as Irish slavery or white slavery in this region at this time, it doesn't dismiss these brutal systems. And in many ways, these brutal systems continue. And I think, you know, for historians, archaeologists, or anybody interested in studying the past, I think what often gets one of the challenges is not letting these studies or this research be sequestered to the past. We need to recognize how these systems change, but continue in very real ways for certain populations. And in the previous question, I mentioned South Asian indentured servants. It was just this past weekend that the New York Times published a scathing expose on sugarcane workers in Western India. And we're just seeing a different version of the same system that was pioneered in the 17th century. And so, you know, these divisions of, you know, well, the Irish did this, the Scottish did this, the Guyanese had this system. Well, it's not as helpful as recognizing some of these similarities across the systems that where we can recognize solidarity and practice from past to present. So I think, you know, to be clear, I think there's also significance in trying to understand someone's origin stories and and kind of respecting their own identity, but at the same time, reflecting the kind of diversity of Caribbean identities and what that means for the present.
Mm-hmm. No, definitely, definitely so. And what do you, you know, your role, do you see that history of the Irish in Anglo-Caribbean playing in the broader discussions? I mean, I know you mentioned part of it about colonialism, labor exploitation, and racial dynamics in the Caribbean.
Oh, I think, you know, it's one of the challenges in my time. I think, you know, I don't want to speak for the Caribbean or for Barbados, especially as not being from there originally. But one of the things that I've noticed in discussions with friends and colleagues over the years, there still exists a partly a lament about the fall of the sugar industry. Different islands have, you know, different degrees of involvement in sugar production. Barbados still has a sugar factory on the island, but it's only one at this time. Others don't have any plantations or factories anymore. And I think for the region, it's a slow questioning of what's next. And many islands have kind of put all their eggs in the tourism basket, but they also recognize the challenges that comes with, especially when COVID hit just a few years ago. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, there's kind of an identity crisis across the island of, well, what comes next now that we know that sugar isn't sustainable? How are we going to build our lifeblood as independent nation states or as a regional kind of economy? And so I think the lessons that can be learned is to, you know, to see to recognize the faults and the pitfalls of systems that were exploitative, that even if you transform them, what are still those shortcomings where someone leaves the sugar field to work in the tourism industry? Where, you know, what are the benefits and advantages to those changes, but also what are the shortcomings? And in terms of the Irish, I think, you know, there's there's ways to celebrate that past without kind of furthering problematic discourse about Irish slavery. I know, for instance, Montserrat celebrates St. Patrick's Day. It's, other than Ireland, the only other country in the world where it's a national holiday. And it's something that recognizes the racial diversity of what that holiday means for its own islanders. And Montserrat, of course, is, you know, a unique case, and so many people had to flee after the volcano in the 1990s. But it's still a unique tradition for the region. And I think there's ways to celebrate those connections that don't kind of pander to this particular political discourse about Irish slavery. Literature is certainly a way to do so. And I think, you know, there's tourism can play a role, or heritage tourism in particular, that acknowledges the painful elements, or what's often referred to as dark tourism, but then some of the signs of collaboration. Doing a tour that can celebrate instances where enslaved and Irish people together were out in acts of rebellion, go through these regions and talk about the complex history of these spaces, even though we don't see it on the landscape as we may have once did in the 17th century. So I think those are some preliminary half-baked thoughts for moving forward.
No, absolutely. Because, I mean, there are still places in the Caribbean that have names that are referenced to Irish to Ireland. So, I mean, to be able to acknowledge that, and I think having this discourse is a perfect example of that, continuing that conversation, just to make sure that we're putting it out there to say, this is what happened. This was another part or a layer of that time frame period. And this is how we just have to look at it.
Absolutely.
So I think that's great. So, and I guess as we end, you know, what do you hope that either the listeners or the viewers are going to take away from, maybe if they read your article, but from this conversation about the complexities of Irish labor migration to the Caribbean during this colonial era?
I think, you know, one element, you know, when we started our conversation, you mentioned a colleague who was Irish that had never heard of the Irish that were sent to the Caribbean. And that's just so common, so typical. And I think what we don't think about, and even within my own circles here in New York, you know, the Caribbean is just so often thought of as a vacation destination. And, you know, it's the region itself was so pivotal in the development of racial capitalism as it came to define the world. And I think, you know, to think of this as a story of English colonialism and then enslaved Africans working in sugar fields, it's a huge part of it. But there are so many other parts of the globe that were intimately linked by these stories and systems that, you know, those links don't go away. They're still there. Sometimes, you know, and I think trying to find them really creates lasting bonds in more positive ways. So I think just awareness of this particular story is an important one, in the sense that, you know, the story of the Caribbean is one of sugar and slavery, but there are those other stories that feed into it that make this a truly global narrative that really define the way that we still live in the 21st century. So I think that's kind of the broader hope, but these kind of micro histories can play a crucial role in helping us better understand how we've come to be the way that we are.
Yes, absolutely. And especially if you are, you know, researching or looking into your family tree, this will definitely uncover it and you'll have more questions to ask. I know when I met one of my relatives, he was 97 years old at the time, and he was just going on and on about all these stories and they mentioned to what you had indicated in terms of a time frame back where, I guess you can kind of say nostalgia, so to speak, where they just, it was a better time, you know, totally different to what it is now. And it's just, as you indicated, where is the direction for the region going to be going at this point in time? So we'll have to see. But as long as we can keep the conversation going, I think that is great. And whoever is researching, for them to kind of look at things differently once they come across a lot of these records and things. So to kind of put things in context. So I do want to thank you, Matt, for coming on to the podcast and discussing this. I really do appreciate your time. So thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
Hoped you enjoyed this episode, and if you did, please make sure to like, follow, subscribe, and write a review for the episode wherever you listen to your podcast. Thank you.